Hello everyone, welcome to this webinar again. I'm Francis Seeley from Global Net 21. And as you know, this is one of the many webinars we do where we look at national, global, and indeed local issues. And today we've got Michael Walling with us. Now, Michael has an organization that he started and that has grown quite considerably called Border Crossings. And it's an organization that works with communities, particularly Indigenous communities. And it does this by art and entertainment. It uses art and entertainment to get a message across about those communities, the plight they're in, what they do in terms of their own survival techniques to have a life that, you know, is survivable. So we're going to talk to him about that today, because what he does is incredibly interesting and also very important as well. So Michael, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks,
and maybe I could start by asking you very briefly a little about yourself.
About me? Okay. I suppose it's the moment where we can do the equal opportunities thing. Let's say that I'm a balding, middle-aged white man and, at the moment sitting in a study surrounded by books, which is in Enfield. And I've lived here now for, since 2006, so 15 years. And my wife and two children live here also. I work in primarily in theatre, but we take a very Catholic view of what that means. So Border Crossings, as you said, it's a cross-cultural theatre company. And then one of the things that the company does is it runs the Origins Festival, which shows the work of Indigenous cultures every 2 years in London, usually. And of course, this year, everything is different. And in some ways, that's been very useful for us, because we've been able to do some things which I think we wouldn't normally have done.
And am I right in saying, as I did in my introduction, it's indigenous communities that you really focus on?
Well, for the Origins Festival, it absolutely is. And, you know, that's an area of our work that has grown significantly over the 12 years now that we've been doing it. We don't just focus on Indigenous communities. I mean, in fact, today I've been working on a proposal for a project with India. We also did a lot of work with China. And we do quite a bit of work in Europe nowadays, more through a sister company in the Republic of Ireland, for obvious reasons, than we do with the UK company. But yes, Indigenous people are really, really central to what we do. And of course, it's because, as you said, there are huge issues around those communities globally. But they are also communities from which we can learn an enormous amount, and their arts and culture are thriving in spite of, you know, centuries of oppression. And we feel it's really important that those voices are heard, particularly here at the former Imperial Centre and, you know, in what remains one of the polluting centres of the world.
Well, I'll ask you about those positive messages in a minute.
Yeah.
You call yourself a multimedia theatre. Is that something you started from the inception, or did COVID take you down that route?
No, it's always been there. COVID's taking us a lot further. we've always used things like video and microphones, pre-recorded music, and also multiple forms of theatre, you know, including the traditional theatres of cultures other than our own. We're interested in the dialogue that emerges not only by talking to people that are different, but also talking through forms that are different. You're quite right that COVID has pushed everyone more towards electronic modes of delivery and the like. But in some ways, we find that because everyone suddenly started doing it, we kind of reacted a bit against it because it just became, oh yes, and of course it's online. I'm interested in ways of trying to gather people physically together, which are still COVID friendly and which still allow for international exchange, but which don't lose the element of human contact, which I think you can lose in online formats. And it's fine for the sort of conversation we're having now, but the sense of what the body can do, I think, is really, really crucial. And the sense of the living body in relationship to the world, to environment, to space and place, are really central to cultural work.
You say that you're based in Enfield. Is that just a place, or do you do anything there? Do you drive? Do you try to connect the local with the global in any way?
Yeah, we do. That has grown since COVID. And I think, you know, everyone's had to think more locally in the last year or so. And I think for us, that's been a big advantage because we've started to see some of what might be on our doorstep. And, you know, we're working now with Capel Manor College. We're working with some local schools, and we've just been working with the council, all of which is about making international connections and connecting to Indigenous communities. But we're starting to do that from our own doorstep, and recognizing that actually a lot of the solutions to the problems we're addressing are ones which you find locally. And you know that.
Yeah, I know that. I mean, you say in your website that you're trying to be a leader in intercultural dialogue between artists and audiences and communities, working through theatre and arts to facilitate mutual understanding, creative collaboration, positive development. Now, that's a really ambitious sort of mission. I mean, how do you go about doing that? How do you turn those words into practice?
I think it's very important to be ambitious in the arts and also in politics. You know, there is so much that needs to change, and it actually needs to happen quite urgently. And if you're not ambitious, then yes, perhaps you'll succeed, but you know, what's the value of it? Some of the greatest people who ever lived were complete failures. You know, Martin Luther King didn't end racism. But look at the glory of the attempt. And, you know, if you're going to be successful, it probably just means your ambitions aren't high enough. So I think it's okay to aim high. And it is about vision. And I think vision is something that's really, really lacking in the world at the moment. Because everything, it becomes very pragmatic. Everything's about what can we do quickly, what's the immediate short-term solution, what will be popular, what will spin well in the press. That's why we've got so many of the problems, is because everything is happening on a short-term basis. So our work is about trying to reconnect people to long-term thinking. And you know, that's one of the reasons that Indigenous cultures are valuable, because Indigenous people do not think in the short term. They think very, very long term. And you can see this when you're in the room with their artists or their elders, that they always look very, very far into the distance. Whereas, you know, Western culture is constantly in short-term distraction, and you know, we're looking about that far in front of our noses at the mobile phone. What's the next message? What's the next immediate thing? And so we're interested in trying to work with people who can reconnect us to slower rhythms, to longer time frames, to bigger pictures, and to longer dreams. I'm not sure this is answering your question about how do we do it practically,
I mean, what you said is it's really good about looking at long-term vision. I mean, you could have concentrated on deprived communities in the UK, for example, who also probably are looking at short-term gains because of the condition they're in. Did you concentrate on Indigenous communities for exactly the reason you've given, that you were looking for how you can get people to look long term? You're right. I mean, I talked this morning in a meeting about short-termism of politics, of democratic politics, that people are unable to see beyond 5-year cycles. Yes. Was your purpose really to find cultures that could bring back to us the idea of the long term?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, indigeneity is about belonging, you know, and the word etymology is always very helpful, isn't it? Being there for a long time, you know, having a real connection to land and locality. and the culture which is expressive of that is absolutely a way of connecting to longer visions and to longer rhythms in terms of the world. And the reason we specifically became involved in indigenous cultures was as a result of a play we did in 2004, which is a long time ago now. There was a play called Bully's House, which was about indigenous Australia and the culture clash between black and white, I suppose, in that continent. And we brought over some indigenous Australian actors to perform in it, and it toured around Britain and it played at the Riverside Studios in Hammersmith. And the reaction of the audience was quite extraordinary. And, you know, on one level, it was a kind of post-colonial guilt of, you know, here I am in the presence of an Aboriginal person. Oh, my goodness. But on another level, I think there was a real hunger for alternative ways of living. I mean, really alternative. I don't mean dropout. I mean different. And the sense that, you know, even 16 years ago, the culture here, particularly younger people, were becoming very aware that the way of life was inadequate, that it not only wasn't sustainable, but actually wasn't particularly meaningful either. And that what they were seeing from the indigenous performers, even though the play was a tragedy and was about the destruction of indigenous cultures, I don't mean permanent destruction, but attempted destruction, perhaps. They were seeing a vitality. They were seeing a connection to nature. They were seeing a depth of cultural understanding and the centrality of cultural practice in in indigenous ways of living, which makes those lives full of meaning. That was very important.
Yeah. I mean, you have a festival of indigenous cultures called Origin, don't you?
Yeah,
to show just those things you've just been talking about. Tell us about that.
Well, Origins was set up on the back of doing Bully's House, because we felt, you know, that hunger needed to be met. And also, I think, because it recognises the need for healing space between you know, Britain as a former colonial power in a lot of countries, and the people who used to own that land and in many ways still do. Therefore a need for a sort of space of negotiation and for us to offer that space and to invite them into it. And that has grown hugely. So, you know, we started doing primarily theatre because we are a theatre company, and you know, we included some films and the like. And we realised quite very quickly that all of this needed contextualising, so that people had to have post-show discussions and debates and lectures. And it started to grow and grow until, you know, now we're working with places like the British Museum. We're working with the South Bank and with, you know, Shakespeare's Globe, the National Maritime Museum. So there's a lot of interaction with major institutions, and there's also a huge variety of art forms and cultural forms. And in the case of, you know, the project with Capel Manor and Hurst Drive School, we're working with gardening. And, you know, how do you grow plants and food in a way that is sustainable and is informed by the cultures of the places which those plants came from in the first place. You know, the most famous immigrant in Britain is the potato, isn't it?
So you're doing all that, and all of that's important in itself, but at the moment you're concentrating on climate issues, aren't you? Why are you doing that?
Well, it's because, of course, there is COP26 coming up in just a few days' time. Well, Greta Thunberg put it very well earlier in the year when she said the people who are actually on the receiving end of this, the people whose voices are probably most important in the global room talking about it, are the ones who aren't going to be able to attend because of COVID. And, you know, even now with the red list countries are almost all in Latin America and include, you know, the countries around the Amazon and the countries around the Andes. where COVID rates have been appalling. And the reason that the COVID rates are so appalling is exactly the same as the decimation of the natural habitat there. That they're constantly marginalised, that their lands are just ridden over roughshod. So we're looking for ways of trying to get Indigenous voices heard. We're looking for ways of trying to foreground those very, very immediate problems. But at the same time, the fact that, you know, as with conservation practices and so on, they are actually the cultures who are offering the solutions.
You say, you know, Indigenous communities, their voices need to be heard. And Indigenous communities are often sometimes the worst people affected by climate change. Do you think that although people are becoming more and more aware globally of climate change, they're still not adequately aware of the impact it has on particular communities and especially Indigenous ones?
Yeah, I think that is absolutely true. And they tend to be off the radar because they're not in the they're not so much in the global interconnectivity of news media, social media, and the like. I mean, this doesn't mean that they're not living in the contemporary world. They absolutely are. But you know, news corporations, Facebook, and so on. You know, these are all based out of capitalist cultures, Western cultures. They're inevitably most interested in other people who are like them. And as a result, I think Indigenous communities do remain off the radar. And it's really important that, you know, people like us, who, you know, have some knowledge, have some interaction with those communities, you know, make use of that to try and shift the balance a little bit and say, actually, we need to listen to these people too. And they, it's about 6% of the planet are Indigenous people, and they control about 22% of the land, and that land has 80% of the world's biodiversity. I mean, it's central. It's absolutely central.
Okay, I mean, so you told us that, which is really important because it puts it in perspective. But can you tell us a little bit more about how they've been affected by climate change? And maybe can you give us one or two examples?
Yeah, we did some work towards the end of last year around the Arctic, which and there's a film actually, which is still online on our website or the British Museum's events YouTube channel. The film's called Magnetic North. And we found ourselves you know, just talking to Inuit and Sami and other people from the Arctic region and discovering the incredible extent of the melting of the ice cap and how it has totally disrupted the way of life there. You know, to the extent that you know, people would go out on the ice at a certain time each year, knowing that that was the time when you could make the hole in the ice and find the fish, or knowing this was the time when the seals would be coming and you could hunt. None of that is now possible because the patterns of climate have changed so drastically. The traditionally known routes across the ice are no longer reliable. So the number of accidents of people just falling through is immense. And as a result, the way of life which connects them to their culture, connects them to their history, is being completely destroyed. They can't do those things anymore. And so Inuit in particular are moving into small communities which have been sort of created for them, I suppose, by colonial governments, and are therefore very dependent on government handouts where they didn't used to be. And this is leading to a great sense of depression and hopelessness, a lack of self-worth. And as a result, Inuit have the highest suicide rates in the world, particularly amongst young men. So that's one shocking story. And then perhaps the other one is in the Amazon region, where the deforestation is so rapid. I mean, it's areas like, I believe, about the size of Great Britain every day are being flattened, primarily for soya, which of course in turn is used to feed cattle, which then fill the sky with methane. As a result, again, you're getting a lot of the indigenous people gathering in new towns, again, cut off from the normal ways of living. And the spread of COVID there has been incredibly high. There's a town in Peru, and I've forgotten the name. It might be Cotis, but don't quote me. But it's in the top end of the Peruvian Amazon. And the infection rate there was running at 80%, which is mind-boggling. So they are very often in particularly dire straits through no fault of their own.
And
it's very hard, yeah.
And when they find themselves in that situation, they also find that they're faced, aren't they, with corporate aggression and criminalization of social protest, which goes hand in hand with that climate change agenda. Are you involved in that as well?
Yes.
I don't mean do you do it. I mean, are you involved in helping them in that situation?
Yes. I mean, at the moment we have Totem Latam out touring its way through the UK towards COP, which we might talk about a bit in a minute. But once it gets the COP, it'll be in the Hidden Gardens in Glasgow, which is also the place where the Minga Indigenous organization gathers, or will be gathering, for the duration of the climate conference. And that's, of course, a protest organization. All of the big protests which have gone on from Indigenous people have started as environmental ones, and the American Indian movement back in the 70s started as an environmental protest. And of course, I'm sure you know about Standing Rock and the pipelines going through the sacred waters. And what we try to do is just draw attention over here to what's going on, and to liaise as best we can with people on the ground. So, for example, we showed a film a couple of festivals ago, which had been made by some filmmakers who were present at Standing Rock, so that we were just hearing directly from the people who were involved and getting a sense of what they were doing and why.
You obviously show people are going through difficult times in dire straits, but you don't just do that, do you? You also give positive news. You talk about what they're doing in terms of creating mutual aid and so on. And we have a lot to learn from that, don't we? Because we've lost that sometimes, and they can show us a model that they have developed over years.
Yeah, absolutely. Environmental protests by Indigenous people are always linked to alternative models. You know, they're never entirely negative, and that's one of the things that I think we can really learn from them. So they don't just say no; they always say, "And this is what we should be doing instead." And there's an extraordinary woman called Winona Duke, who came to Origins in 2015 and gave a lecture, which you can still hear as a podcast on our, again, on from our site. And Winona runs something called the White Earth Project in Minnesota, part of which is about food sovereignty and water sovereignty over wild rice, which is the only natural grain, or indigenous grain, perhaps we should say, that grows in the Americas. So, you know, all those wheat fields, massive import. But wild rice is harvested from the lakes. And one of the key points she made was, don't take too much, which is, of course, what happens when it goes onto an industrial scale, which means it can't reproduce naturally, and you don't get the harvest the next time. And so you then get into the artificial planting, and you're losing the natural rhythm, which is when you start creating disturbance in the ecosystem and you start pumping chemicals into it, and it all goes wrong. But if you take what's needed for a community which lives nearby, and we're back with localism again, then actually it's fine. And you know, those sorts of models we really need to think about. And this is why we're doing the gardens project. It's called Botany Bay, because we want to explore what that way of thinking might mean for people right here and what we can learn from that.
Yeah, I mean, we often look upon mutual aid as something we do when society fails, when politics fails.
Yeah.
But it's not, is it? It's something we should be doing anyhow. We've lost that. And therefore, we've lost, in a way, a sense of resilience.
Yeah, yeah. I couldn't agree more. Yeah, you're absolutely right, Francis. And you know, resilience, it's not even that, actually. Because resilience sounds like, well, when you've got a problem. But as you say, it should be there just inbuilt that it's about reciprocity. It's about the earth gives us something, so we give something back. You know, even if that's just embedded in a way of thinking, like, which is why indigenous cultures often use ceremonies as a way of talking to the environment, and recognizing that it has some sort of equal status with us. I think, you know, the arrogance of Western cultures in assuming that we're different, that we're separate, that we own it, this is all nonsense. I mean, how can you own the earth? It's nonsense. And yet our whole culture is based on the assumption that we do.
Okay, so you mentioned that climate change is your focus because COP26 is on, and you're going to COP26.
Yeah,
and you're going there for a specific reason. You're going to show something. Tell us about that.
Okay, this is Totem Latamat, which was in Enfield not that long ago. It's a totem which we commissioned from a Totonac artist. The Totonac are an indigenous culture in northern Mexico, in the area of state of Veracruz. And we wanted to find, as I said earlier, a way of getting an indigenous voice into the mix and trying to make it as prominent as we could. And so we commissioned an artist called Hun Tiburcio. Hun means hummingbird in the language of the Totonac, and traditionally the hummingbirds are the messengers in Totonac culture. So it has this rather beautiful synchronicity around his name. And he said that he would be excited to do this. He carved it from a single cedar tree, which they cut down with a ceremony to thank it for giving its life for this purpose. And he worked with the whole village to turn this into this incredibly beautiful totem. And it traveled across the Atlantic in a sea container. And we brought it first of all to Chiswick House in West London, where we cut open the seal of the container and the amazing smell of the cedar came out. It was blessed by a shaman. There's an Ecuadorian Quechua shaman who lives and works in London, and it's traveling slowly up through the country. It came to Enfield, as I said, into Milton Keynes. It went to a stone circle in Oxfordshire. So it's we're seeing it in different places which complement each other and which set up different resonances. So, you know, sometimes in very urban spaces, sometimes against ancient buildings or in the stone circle, you know, ancient woodlands, really. And finally, it will go to COP26, to a place called the Hidden Gardens, where it'll be surrounded by indigenous delegates. And what we hope will happen is that on its journey, it will provoke people to think. And, you know, there are all sorts of things around it. So there are talks, there are ceremonial events, there's a little treasure trail which children are doing at the moment in Hexham. There's a podcast where Hun talks about the meaning he's contained within the iconography of the totem. And I hope people will also take note that just after he finished building it, Hurricane Grace hit the state of Veracruz and half of Hun Tiburcio's house was knocked down. And there's a kind of hideous irony in that you know, here he was talking through his art about the need to combat climate change, and then, you know, his own life gets so deeply, deeply affected by that very thing. But he said to us, it's devastating and terrifying when your life is exposed to climate change in that way, but it's also galvanizing, and it makes you realize how very, very important it is that the whole world starts to come together and think these things through.
Okay, coming back to a local sort of question, someone's put up Michelle. She said, ambitiously, she said, could the Botany Bay Capel Manor Gardening Project be showcased at the Chelsea Flower Show next year?
Good idea.
Have you thought of that?
We hadn't thought of it, Michelle, and we should. I will talk to the people at Capel Manor and at the various schools involved, and we will see. It's not a garden design in the conventional sense, though. I mean, in many ways, of course, what happens with Indigenous horticulture is it looks rather messy because things aren't in neat rows, and they are. It's much more natural. So, for example, the Native American way of growing pumpkins. I just picked that because it's Halloween week. It's one of three sisters, the pumpkin, the maize, and the bean all grow together because they complement each other, because the chemicals which come off one actually feed another. And because the maize grows first, the bean then wraps itself around the maize and goes upwards. And then this is also used by native people in their cuisine. So you get three sisters flowers, and you get flowers salads, and you get three sisters banquets, where all those three vegetables are cooked at the same time. Now, there's no reason why we shouldn't send the garden that looks like that to Chelsea. It might be quite exciting. I don't know if it would win on conventional terms, but it might ruffle a few feathers, and that's no bad thing, I think.
Yeah, I mean, Michelle's also talking about you being involved in the National Theatre as well, which would be a good thing to do. But I mean, she said, let's ruffle some feathers because what you're doing is so important. But we've sort of come to the end now of the time that we've got. And, you know, if anybody wanted to find out more about you and what you do, where would they go and how would they make contact?
Well, there's two websites, bordercrossings.org.uk, and from that one, it's very easy to get to the other one, which is originsfestival.com. And we're on Facebook, and we're on Twitter, and we're on Instagram, and they're all very busy. And actually, at the moment, are proving incredibly useful because, you know, with the totem going through the country, what we really want is lots of photographs of it, and that's all happening.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for doing that interview because it's been really interesting, and you're obviously doing some important work and some work which I think is important for people to see and watch because they need to learn from it. You know, the situation that many communities are facing across the world, and you're certainly doing a lot of work to do that. And I think it's important to do what Michelle said in her comment to ruffle feathers on this, to let people know exactly what's happening, and that climate change is not something that's going to happen in a few years. It's happening now, and it's happening now to many communities who are going to suffer very badly and are suffering very badly. So thanks for joining us, and it's been great to talk to you. And if you have any other information you can send us, or anything on YouTube, we'll put that up on sites as well so people can know about it. So send that to me, and I'll make sure it goes up and people see what you're doing. And if you have anything, any video from COP26 when you're there as well, that would be great.
Well, we will. We're taking our film cinematographer and photographer with us. So, I'm sure we'll have something.
Okay, well, if you do and you let us have that, then for sure we will, we'll let people see that as well. Anyhow, thanks for doing it, Michael. And
Not at all. Thank you for all you're doing in Enfield as well. It's, it's really, really important.
Okay, but it's nice to hear the stories of what other people are doing and what so many, many people are doing in Enfield and beyond as well, globally. And that's important. So thanks again. And we'll end this webinar now.
Thanks a lot. Cheers.